Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Elizabeth Moran, attorney registration number 16119, and I represent the defendant, Philip Bowen, M.D., in this Rule 21 proceeding. The court, I know, is familiar with the general background of the case, but just briefly, this is a medical negligence case. Mr. Garrigan claims that he suffered postoperative vision loss following a lengthy spine surgery and claims that it was due to negligence on the part of the anesthesiologist, Dr. Bowen. He claims that Dr. Bowen inadequately monitored and managed the anesthesia care during the procedure, which, according to Mr. Garrigan's theory, caused a deprivation of oxygen to his optic nerves, resulting in a condition known as postoperative vision loss. The parties endorsed various expert witnesses, and one of defendant's expert witnesses is Dr. Lori Lee. Dr. Lee is an anesthesiologist. She is a researcher, and she is an author of several studies addressing issues of postoperative vision loss. She was endorsed to testify both as to standard of care, that Dr. Bowen's care met the standards, his monitoring and his management of the anesthesia met accepted standards of care, and also to address issues about the cause of postoperative vision loss and the state of medical knowledge regarding the causes of postoperative vision loss. In her endorsement, it was stated that her opinions were based on her knowledge and expertise, her review of the medical records in this case, and her review of medical literature, and the endorsement listed approximately 40 articles that Dr. Lee was relying on. And one of those articles is a 2006 study in which Dr. Lee herself participated as primary author, which consisted of a collection of almost 100 cases of postoperative vision loss, which the researchers reviewed in an effort to try and determine what the factors are during surgery that might be causing postoperative vision loss. The conclusions of the study were basically that there is not any single factor or combination of factors that can be identified as being a cause of postoperative vision loss. There are some factors which seem to be associated with it, but association is different from saying cause, such as the length of the surgery and the estimated blood loss during the procedure. In the course of this litigation, plaintiff demanded that Dr. Lee, or demanded through Dr. Bowen, that all of the study data underlying this study be produced to the plaintiff so that the plaintiff could look at the raw materials, recreate the study if necessary, check the accuracy.
This just isn't about the report. You know, or the article. Presumably she could produce that, right?
The article was produced. It was cited in the the endorsement and was produced during the litigation.
But she didn't have the underlying data.
No, and the reason she doesn't have the underlying data is because that data is held in a registry by the University of Washington. And the University of Washington does not authorize Dr. Lee, who is simply a researcher in the registry, to release that data. It's in the possession, custody, and control of the university. When the plaintiff requested this information from Dr. Bowen, the plaintiff was informed that Dr. Bowen does not have possession, custody, or control of this information, and neither does Dr. Lee. It is with the University of Washington, and if the plaintiff wished to subpoena the University of Washington to try to get that data, that was something that the plaintiff could do.
However, is it correct, as I think the trial judge found, that Dr. Lee did use that data in forming her opinions on this case?
What the trial court ruled was, and Dr. Lee testified, I did not go back and re-review the data in connection with my retention in this case or forming my opinions in this case. The trial court didn't say that was not true or inaccurate. What the trial court said was, well, she must have considered it in forming her opinions in this case because she considered it and reviewed it when she was forming her conclusions for the study in 2006.
Brent, on that precise point, your disclosure statement that you filed on her behalf in five different paragraphs specifically refers to the data that Dr. Lee says, from the data in this study, the evidence showed the etiology of ION remains unknown, etc. There are five different paragraphs in your disclosure statement that specifically refer to the data. So it seems to me that I can't quite understand, you know, how you can be both a researcher, frankly, and also a forensic expert. It seems like it's an oxymoron, you know. If you're going to shield the data and testify to it, then I don't think you can do that, which is basically what I think the trial judge said.
When the disclosure was drafted, this was before this issue arose, with the demand for the underlying study materials, all the raw data that was gathered and so forth. The data that is really being referred to in the disclosure statement is the data that's set forth in the article. And what the article does is it summarizes data about blood pressure measurements in patients. It summarizes data about the types of fluids that were administered and the volume of fluids and whether that was seen to make any difference. So what those references to data refer to are the data that's described in the published article, because Dr. Lee did not go back and look at the raw records, the data collection sheets, patient medical records, the underlying data that was collected in this study from 1999 to 2006. And so the trial court's conclusion was that because she considered the data when she was reviewing it for the study, and because she's going to be talking about the study conclusions in her testimony, she must have considered that data in forming her opinions in this case, even though she didn't go back and re-review it.
Yes,
sir.
There's a general, I know you're very experienced and all that, but there's a general idea that an expert can testify to, you know, generally accepted theories, scientific theories, and you don't have to, you know, get chapter and verse in discovery, right? I mean, we all agree with that. Mm-hmm. So are you saying that this research that she conducted and the data, the 100 or so cases, which leads her to her conclusions, are like that in this field? Are one of the generally accepted measures, you know, in this field? I mean, to me, that's a bit of a stretch. This is especially the kind of thing that, and she's supposedly a super-duper expert who's done all this work, and people can't question it because obviously the university wants to keep it confidential, the identity of the people and so forth.
I don't think it's really a question of general acceptance. It's a question of an expert relying upon medical literature, which is done all the time. And it just so happens that she was a researcher for this particular medical article, which is one of many that address the same subject, and she would have based her testimony on all of these articles. And the difference is that the plaintiff wants all the data from this study when she does not have it in her possession, custody, or control. And it's not, you know, all the cases about what an expert is required to produce as being things they considered are things that were given to the expert by an attorney or by a party, things that an expert prepared for a party or for the attorney in the course of the litigation, or sometimes materials that an expert prepared for a party as a consultant before litigation arose, in the capacity of being either a consultant or an employee to the party. All those things are things that are typically ordered to be produced. This is a research study that was conducted begun several years before this case even arose, before Mr. Geerken even had his surgery. The data was collected from 1999 to 2006. This was not a study commissioned by Dr. Bowen. He had nothing to do with the study. He had nothing to do with Dr. Lee. This was performed for the American Society of Anesthesiologists and the University of Washington.
As the trial judge noted, I think it's ironic that she is the person who is the most familiar with this study and the most, therefore, the most qualified to make an opinion, and because she is, in fact, the most familiar, she had access to the rough data, she's the one who doesn't get to testify, as opposed to the other two doctors who only read the report or were more tangentially familiar with the study.
And that's correct. And the trial.
But how do we get around that in terms of the rule? I mean, it does create this irony, doesn't it? Because if she's playing, kind of putting herself in two different positions, that of a person who is collecting raw data and created an opinion based upon that raw data, and then second step, taking that opinion that she created earlier to opine about this particular case. And so that raw data is not really insulated by that intermediate step, that is writing an article and then relying upon the article to opine. That's what makes this an interesting and difficult case.
It is interesting, but I think it, you know, part of the problem lies in saying that she is expressing opinions in the study, and it's, you know, that.
Well, it's not so much opinions as it's data upon which she bases her opinion. So we have data equals an opinion, and then she relies on that opinion to express another opinion. Mm-hmm. So where does that stop, kind of, that chain?
I think where it stops is looking at the boundaries of the litigation, and did it have anything to do with the litigation? Here it does not. It's really the expert's knowledge that she's developing before she has any contact with the
Do you think it's just akin to going to school or something else? You wouldn't have to produce every textbook you ever looked at, or
it's
every study that the textbook referred to?
Yes, and you know, the question is, well, where do you draw the line? And I think you draw the line at what's the litigation about, where did it begin, and when did the expert become involved in the litigation?
Well, if this, you also seem to emphasize the fact that the data is not in her custody and control. Your answer be different if it weren't? Let's say she's still in the primary researcher and she's got all the data in her basement. Would she have to turn it over?
I think if she had not re-reviewed, you know, the box of patient records that she hadn't looked at, you know, since she summarized it 10 years ago, I would say no, the answer would not be different. Had she reviewed some of that data again, I think the answer is yes, it needs to be produced. And that is the point. You know, there are not many courts that have faced a question like this before. The two that I found are the Langbord case, Langbord versus Department of Treasury, and the Euclid Chemical case. And they draw the line at where the litigation begins and what's the connection with the litigation, and did the expert re-review the raw data?
Well, it seemed like your answer is a little bit different from the position you were taking in this case, though, because I thought you were saying to Garion's counsel that if he wants the raw data, he should go get it from the University of Washington. You know, file a SDT with them at school.
That is part of the response. We also felt she did not consider it for the purposes of Rule 26. But if she did, and if that was the trial court's finding, which it was, then it's not, because the discovery rules, Rule 34, Rule 45, and even Rule 26, when they talk about production of documents, it's only documents that are within the possession, custody, or control of a party, or in the case of Rule 45, a non-party, which is Rule 45 is the way that you get records that are in the custody and control of a non-party. That if the plaintiff wants to try and get this information, they need to go to the party, or the non-party in this case, the University of Washington, that has the possession, custody, or control of this information. The Attorney General for the University of Washington has signed an affidavit saying the reasons that Dr. Lee cannot produce this data, and that they will respond to a subpoena. I don't know what the results of that might be, but that's up to the University of Washington, because this is their data.
Here's my question, and I'm looking at the judge's order on the third page. I think this might be what Justice Bender was referring to as well. He says the doctor can't claim she never saw the data because she is one of the authors, and everybody will agree with that. But then he goes on and says, The expert disclosures also clearly indicate, twice in fact, that you will testify based on the data in the study. I think that's maybe what you were referring to. And then the judge concludes, at a minimum, she considered these data to form the opinions expressed in the study, and I don't have any trouble with that. So the sentence that concerns me is, expert disclosures clearly indicate, twice in fact, that she will testify based on the data in the study, which seems to suggest that she didn't just reread the report, that she somehow reviewed the data and cut out that what I'm calling that intervening step.
Mm-hmm. As I noted earlier, the disclosure statement was drafted before this issue of producing the underlying materials ever came up. I guess the word data was used a little loosely, because what was, and I believe I addressed that I was looking for it. I thought it was in my reply brief. It's in a footnote in one of my briefs, to explain. Oh, it's reply brief footnote 2 on page 14. If you look at what is being talked about in the endorsement when we're talking about data, it's referring to the data that's disclosed in the written paper, the 6-page or 7-page article that was published in 2006, which does talk about some values for blood pressure, fluid volumes, things like that. I mean, there's numbers in there and there's data in there, but we weren't talking about, and we weren't intending to produce or even get into any underlying patient records, data collection charts, notes of the researchers, summaries, anything like that. That was simply not our intent. The issue hadn't arisen.
So help me here. You say data is being used in two different ways with two different meanings. Are you interpreting the court's order that way as well, or is the court's order mistaken because it's using data with the singular with the same concept and based on something that uses it in a different manner?
The way I read the court's order is that the court is saying you use data in the endorsement, and the way we're talking about data now after we've gone through this whole issue of do you produce all this underlying stuff is the trial court was equating the two, and that was not what was intended in the endorsement because the issue hadn't even come up.
So you'd agree that even under your test, once she'd been retained, if she had gone back and looked at those patient records and used them to formulate her opinion, she'd have to disclose them?
If she went back and looked for them for this case, yes, I think so.
How do you, I think the next paragraph after that in this order kind of indicates that, it says the other expert wasn't personally involved, but what? How do you do with 26? I guess B1, the data or other information considered by the witness in forming the opinions. Even if she hadn't looked at the data in giving giving an opinion for you, that let's assume that to be accurate, she's still using the data from her information. It's the study. That according to, generally speaking, that everybody relies upon, or that she's going to rely upon the results of it. So it still would have to be tested by cross-examination.
Again, the use of that information that you acquire before you hit the litigation, before you've ever heard of the case or have ever been retained in the case, there's just no logical endpoint to what you would have to produce.
Wait a minute. A judge can always temper, a reasonable discovery request, but in order to test a scientific thesis that's being offered as an expert in a case like this, the other side experts ought to have an opportunity to make sure that her conclusions are based in fact upon these 93 cases that she claims, or at least have some aspect, which I think is the intent of the discovery rules. And if you can't do that, then I think you're narrowing it down for just what the expert does on this particular case. If you have an expert that gives an opinion about something based on only research that person has done but did it 15 years ago, and I'm sorry, you can't have the data for it, no one's ever heard of it, that doesn't seem fair. And I think that's what the judge's opinion's getting.
Well, the same could be said of an expert relying on any medical article, that you have to go back and test the basis. And I think away from reviewing, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Wait a minute, I think that's not accurate, because it's generally accepted that accepted medical principles, you don't have to do that. This is not. This is a very special area.
Well, I think the bigger problem, if I can just add to that question, is the fact that she was a researcher and had access to that data. It would be different to me if, for example, if someone came in and said, you know, I reviewed this article as part and its conclusions, and I'm relying upon those. And I would say, okay, fine, you don't have to go any farther. But if somebody came in and said, I looked at the rough data and I made those conclusions based upon the rough data, I massaged that data. I'm the person who worked with that data, and I came up with these conclusions, and now I'm incorporating them into my opinion. And it seems to me like that's what makes this case a little bit different. What is your response to that, please?
My response to that is that this is a doctor who has performed research and acquired knowledge about a specialized area, and will testify about her conclusions in that area. It's no different, really, from a doctor who comes in to talk about the standard of care and says, I think that surgery A is safer than surgery B, because in my experience and the experience of my colleagues at the hospital, we've done a number of these surgeries, and we've observed that the complications are fewer with A and the recovery time is quicker. Well, is that really true?
That's an odd comparison, because you're talking now about an opinion based on the experience, whereas here it seems to me you're talking about an opinion based on the study of the raw data. It seems distinguishable, isn't it?
The type of data is different, but I think that the principles are the same, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this then. The rule talks about whether the data was considered, or the information data was considered in forming the opinion. The court's order uses that same language, considered. You've been talking about that we should somehow qualify that so that there's I think you were talking about a look sort of aspect to it. That is, if I understood you right, had the doctor actually looked at this stuff after she was retained, that would be different than the fact that whether or not it's in her possession, that she didn't actually look at it. So I think that's the qualification. If I accepted that, I guess my concern there would be that seems somewhat superficial. That is, if you actually look at it recently, then it goes into one category. But if you're sufficiently familiar with it that you don't actually need to look at it recently, then it goes into another category. And maybe you can help me understand why that's a better pivot than considered.
I think it's very consistent with this court's interpretation of considered in the Gall versus Jameson case, where the court, although that actually concerned whether an expert had to produce attorney work product that had been sent to the expert, but the explanation that the court gave for the term considered was read or reviewed before or in connection with forming the opinions. And that's a very practical application, and it's actually based on a number of federal cases who have actually used the read and reviewed definition for what is considered, because that is a very reasonable way to distinguish between what an expert is looking at for the case and what an expert knows in her head before she ever knows anything about the case. And I think it's important in terms of balancing the burden of discovery to draw that line between what an expert gets for the case and what an expert knows and how they know it, because once you get into that, the line is very hard to draw, especially here when it's information that neither Dr. Bowen nor Dr. Lee had in their possession, custody, or control. And of course, that's the other side of the argument. In short, I would ask the court to look carefully at the trial court's order. I believe that the trial court misinterpreted the way the rules of discovery need to be applied, both in terms of possession, custody, or control, ruling that Rule 26 expert disclosures aren't limited by that, because no other discovery rule requires production of something that's not within your possession, custody, or control. And even Rule 26.1, initial disclosures only require production of documents.
Is this really a viable alternative subpoena you just taken for the Washington, University of Washington's files?
It may be. The affidavit that's executed by Mr. Johnson, the Attorney General, says it goes through the reasons why they don't allow Dr. Lee to produce the information. In accordance with its commitments to research subjects, the mandates of federal law and university policy with respect to ongoing research data, in a context such as this, the university releases such data only where it is required to do so in response to the enforcement of a lawfully issued and properly served subpoena or a court order directed to the university itself. So the
trial judge could issue such an order?
I'm not sure if there would be jurisdiction over the University of Washington. But
isn't there a reciprocal procedure with another state to get one issued?
Yeah.
It's very difficult. It is.
That wasn't explored in this case, nor was the mechanism for letters rogatory or issuance of a commission through the state courts of Washington. That was not attempted. That was offered to plaintiff, and they haven't pursued that. So for these reasons, I would ask the court to make the rule absolute, and I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal unless there are any further questions from the court. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Damon Davis. I am counsel for Philip Garrigan. My attorney number is 34323. With me today is Mr. Keith Killian. This court should affirm the trial court's order excluding the testimony of Lori Lee for three reasons. First, the plain language and policy of Rule 26A2B1 requires an expert to produce all information the expert considered. Second, the trial court did not commit clear error in finding that Lee considered the data underlying the POVL study when her opinions were repeating her conclusions from the study as she clearly took the data into account. And third, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in excluding Lee's testimony because without the underlying data, the truth of Lee's opinions cannot be fully examined at trial. I'd like to address the issue, begin with the issue of whether Lee considered this data, because that seems to be an important issue in this case. And I would submit, to begin with, some of the questions asked about the issue, and I would submit that being the author and the researcher who developed this article is different than being a doctor who has simply looked at someone else's article and someone else's research and is requesting it.
And this is really a puzzle to me. Of course, that's why we have the case, is that the one who has actually done the research, done the original writing, writes up the report, and so on, has a special disadvantage here because of the underlying data not being available except through some laborious mechanism, and then that person is disqualified. It just doesn't make, to me, good policy sense that the rules operate in that direction, you know? In other words, the farther removed you are from the underlying studies, the more easy it is to express your opinion. And that just doesn't seem instinctively right.
Well, it is correct when you think about the purpose of the rules being the truth-seeking function and the testing of the experts' opinions through cross-examination and counter-experts. If the person has simply read the study and is then using it in their opinions, they can be cross-examined on that fact. They can say, look, yeah, I've read the article, I'm relying upon that article, but I didn't read it, I don't know what the underlying data is. But for the author of the study, who has, they can say, these are my opinions, I know this article is good because I created it. I did the research, I looked up the data, I compiled it, and so I know this is a good opinion.
Does it matter what the data is? in a particular case?
I wouldn't think it would matter what the data is for the particular expert if the expert considered the data, and that gets into the issue of what's considered.
And what do you know about the character of this data? Is it reports of a bunch of surgeries? That's what it sounded like to me, but I don't know.
That is my understanding, is that the data largely comes from what they call closed claim files, which is actually lawsuits over post-operative visual loss, and they submit the data from those cases to this database, plus there's voluntarily submitted information, which is compiled, and the study is done under, it's within the University of Washington, it's funded and controlled by the ASA Committee on Professional Liability, and Dr. Lee is the director of that study, and they're still collecting data, as I understand, as we speak, that they're still accepting submissions.
And these are not cases in which Dr. Lee herself was involved, as far as we know, right? There are reports of other surgeries.
As far as I know, but I don't know for sure whether she's done any of them that are involved in the study or not. But they're not all hers.
Does it make any difference whether this is cutting-edge research or not? Would it make any difference if this was research she had done on how you do blood type testing, which the scientists have known about for 100 years, versus whether it was brand new ways of doing DNA testing? Would that make a difference for your purposes?
I'm not sure that it would, Your Honor, because ultimately what you have to look at is what are the experts' opinions in this case. And the only way you can test those opinions, their reliability, the credibility of the expert in testifying to them, whether they even comply with Rule 702, is to look at how those opinions were arrived at, which most often you're going to have to look at the data. And if the expert considered that underlying data, you have to test the expert's opinions. Regardless of what the study is, but I think it's especially true, if you have a new study which has opinions no one else has reached, the case is probably stronger for it, which gets to the issue of the court's discretion, the trial court. When are they going to exercise their discretion to either say this is too far afield and we're not going to allow discovery into it, or this is on point, we are going to allow. So it might affect the court's discretion in what sanction to issue or whether to order production. But the basic principle, you have to provide the data you consider, doesn't change based on what the study is.
So what you'd want to do with your expert is have him or her go over all of these 90 studies and rewrite this article. Because essentially that's what you're proposing.
We want the underlying data, and we do want our expert to review it all and determine whether the conclusions reached in the study, conclusions which the trial judge found Dr. Lee is repeating in her opinions. So she's taking the article she wrote, she's repeating those opinions in this case, and we want to see if those opinions are valid based on the data, and that was contained in...
And yet, as to sort of express, to continue with Justice Hobbs' thought, the doctors who didn't prepare that article can simply opine that they have looked at that article and they agree with it, and go on with their testimony from there. I mean, that's correct. The irony of your position, isn't it? The trial judge noted that as well.
Correct. And the issue is, we have to put the parties on an equal footing. And if Lee has access to this data and can tell the jury she has access to this data and she knows the report is right, and the defendant's brief seems to indicate that's what defendant intends to have her testify about, that puts the defendant, Dr. Bowen, at an advantage, because his expert has this data, his expert can look at this data and render opinions based on it, and our expert never has a chance to look at it and see whether it is right or wrong.
It seems to me that underlying this sort of discomfort with the difference that you've been asked about a couple of times is kind of the notion that that there may be other reasons that it's too difficult, it's impossible to get those sort of things why it's too burdensome for this witness to have to, this expert witness for Dr. Lee to have to produce that data. But isn't it true that the pursuant to the rule, notwithstanding the trial court's findings about the data being considered and forming the opinion here, there are plenty of other avenues, had it been brought to the court and had the court chosen to do so, to limit that production, even though the court thought it was considered and would be testified to, as the court indicated. That is, that it's unduly burdensome, that there's improper motivation for requesting it, those sorts of things.
Correct. There's ample opportunity for the court, the trial court, to use its authority to enter protective orders and to examine these various items, and that's something that the trial court can do in its discretion. It can certainly take account of those things, both in ordering production or in considering what the appropriate sanction would be in a given case. And I'd like to also clarify on this issue of consideration, because it's been argued how far abroad do you go. A plaintiff is submitting a proposition that, you know, this data and the POBL study relates directly to Lee's opinions. The judge found that her opinions come directly out of the article. They certainly inform her opinion. It states that she's going to testify based on the data. So this is not general type of information that would be wide in scope or broadly applicable. It's not the generally applicable medical opinions. It's not general background experience, but it's on the specific issue at trial, which is the loss of sight after a surgery. So it's very specific. It's not general information, nor is it background information, which would be the type of information that's the common to the profession and is basic to the profession. And an example is generally accepted accounting principles for accountants. That's not going to have to be provided. It's generally known throughout accounting what generally accepted accounting principles are. This is not such a case.
Let me ask you this question. If she had performed these 90 surgeries and came into the courtroom and said, well, based upon my experience doing these 90 surgeries, I'm going to have such and such an opinion, you're not taking the position that this doctor would have to disclose the patient files for each of these 90 surgeries?
No.
So what was really happening here is that she reviewed 90 surgeries, she compiled them into an article, and then said, this is why I'm saying there's really an extra step here that we're having so much trouble with. And then she said, oh, well, based upon my article, I'm reviewing it. So what is really the difference? I mean, why does, whether she performed these 90 surgeries, we don't have to look at the patient records, but if she compiles it into an article, we do. What's the distinction there that we're trying to get at?
The distinction is really in the data.
Well, but you're not making us disclose the data or the doctor disclose the data if she did the surgeries herself.
Well, if she did the surgeries herself, then she's applying her general experience and general knowledge. There's no direct comparison of those surgeries to this surgery, and that's ample fodder for cross-examination to say, well, you haven't given us the records for all these surgeries. We don't know whether these surgeries are really similar to this case.
Well, right, but you wouldn't be entitled to those records either, and that's the point. You want to cross-examine that way, but you would not be entitled to those surgeries.
Correct.
So now, why are you not entitled to those in surgeries while you're taking the position that you are entitled to these records of surgeries which were compiled into an article?
The records that Dr. Lee is using, the data that she compiled, is the foundation, is what she considered in reaching her opinions, and it's specific and it's identifiable and it's directly on point. Every surgery, if you're looking at surgeries, every surgery is different, and every surgery is going to be a little bit different than any other surgery, and the records won't necessarily be directly compatible with the case in front of the jury.
I'm still not seeing the distinction, though, between reviewing 90 surgeries and doing 90 surgeries. I mean, everything that you've said would apply in both instances.
Well, reviewing the 90 surgeries, reviewing the underlying data, I think what you have to look at and what the federal courts have looked at is said, is this data directly on point to the opinions. And the Kodak case kind of made this distinction. They said, look at what the statistician reviewed for his opinions. And they said, well, his conclusions, he doesn't cite on or rely upon any of his previous statistical conclusions in reaching his opinion, but he does rely on the methodology of his previous statistical analyses. So you can get the methodology, even though he did all these opinions and he did all this research prior to being made an expert. And that's the real issue, is does the information apply directly to the opinions that the expert is going to give? There's just sort of general background information that would be applicable to essentially any case or any use of medical knowledge. And what they said, what the federal courts have looked at is this information directly bear upon the opinions that the expert is going to give? Does it directly bear upon the issue at trial? 90 previous surgeries, the experience and knowledge gain does, but those 90 surgeries don't. But if you're compiling data and saying, I'm going to look at this data, reach a bunch of conclusions based just upon that data, that really does inform your opinion. It goes specifically to the heart of what your opinion is on the specific case. And again, even if some general background knowledge is caught up within this data, the court has ample means to enter protective orders to protect overly broad or parties from going too far afield in their discovery.
Mr. Davis? Can I ask you to switch to Ms. Moran's other argument, which is, are there cases that say that under Rule 26 for expert disclosure that you can compel or you should have voluntary disclosure of materials, assuming that they are relevant for a second, that are not in the possession, custody, or control of the party? Because I'm not aware of any, but I just wonder how you get around, how do we deal with that?
Well, I think you start with the plain language of the rule, which says, quote, all opinions to be expressed and the basis and reasons, therefore, semicolon, the data or other information considered, unquote.
Yeah, but that, wait a second, but that's not the beginning part.
No.
It's a mandatory disclosure. It says under 26A, B, you got to do this in possession control. It refers to Rule 34, which is clearly possession and control. And then it says, I agree with you about the data business, but it says disclosure of expert testimony. You have to, I guess you could read it. It says, in addition to the disclosures required by subsection A1, the parties shall disclose to other parties, so forth. And these disclosures shall include. But I think the inference is that it's all within the custody or possession and control of the expert.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, because if you look at the other rules, they explicitly state information or documents within the possession, custody, and control of the individual under 34 or 26A1.
Sure.
It doesn't say that in 26A2B. And if you follow the general principle, words have meaning. So if it says that in one part, the drafters obviously knew how to put that in. If it doesn't say in a different part, that has meaning. So that should not be read into the second part, unto 26A2B, because it's not there. And courts have held, at least the Colorado Court of Appeals and the Seventh Circuit have held, that even if you can't comply with the rule, if the rule requires you to provide something, you have to provide it, and if you don't, a sanction is appropriate. Now, it's not specifically on identical facts, but they are, I would submit, analogous facts.
That's my sort of question. I don't remember reading from the briefs that you had a case on point on a document or something that was not in the custody, possession, or control of the expert.
Well, I think one case that is similar is the Fidelity case, which is a Seventh Circuit case. We cited it. In that case, the accountant had the records, all the records he used from his interviews. Pursuant to the company policy, he got rid of those records, at least the ones he didn't think were applicable to his opinions, and could no longer produce them. And the Seventh Circuit said, your company's policy of getting rid of these documents doesn't matter. You have to provide them, and the fact that you no longer have them is not an excuse for failing to provide them. And a sanction is still going to be appropriate. And I would submit this case isn't that different. Here, Lee considered the underlying data, reviewed it. It's her data. It says in her opinion that she's going to use this data. But her employer is saying, you can't provide this data. We're going to not allow you to provide the data. The fact that her employer is not allowing her to provide data she considered is not an excuse for failing to comply with the rules of civil procedure.
She isn't allowed to testify at all under the judge's ruling, right?
Correct.
Now, isn't there some lesser sanction that could apply here? I mean, certainly she could be asked about the methodology and so on that she utilized, you know, the testing, you know, to be sure that she scientifically, you know, has a foundation for her testimony and so on. She is trying to aid the tribunal, after all. We do favor the role of expert witnesses to opine in areas of their expertise. Now, how about the area of, you know, could some cautionary instruction have been given in the case?
In theory, a lesser sanction could be utilized, but in this case, such a sanction wouldn't be appropriate, in large part because the judge found she's repeating opinions from this article. And I think if you compare the article that she wrote to her opinions that she's going to offer in this case, they are virtually identical. They're based on the same data. She reaches the same conclusions. It's essentially a summary of her article. So virtually all of her opinions are going to be informed by the underlying data, and there's no way to test that without that underlying data. So the court
could the jury be advised that she doesn't have the documents, they can't be obtained, they ought to take that into account and determine what kind of weight to give to her opinion?
In some cases that might work. I would submit in this case it would not work because it is so much based on that data, and Mr. Garrigan has none of it in order to either develop counter opinions of a counter expert, so we can't have another expert come in and say she misinterpreted or misunderstood the data, can't adequately cross-examine her even though the jury's instructed about this. And finally, I would submit that the judge is in the best position to decide what the appropriate sanction is. And Judge Bacher found that the appropriate sanction was exclusion. And it's not a particularly harsh sanction in this case because there are two other experts. So it's not as if the litigation is going to be over, as though Dr. Bowen's automatically going to lose because he loses this one.
Just lesser sanctions, things discussed at the trial court level, considered by the judge, argued by counsel?
I know we discussed alternative sanctions. I'm not sure to what degree they were raised. I know we asked for a stronger sanction as well. I think we suggested the possibility. I know we asked for a stronger sanction. I think we discussed the potential.
We asked for a default judgment.
We did ask for default judgment. We believed that's
a stronger. Nevertheless, you're asking for a sanction for a discovery violation, though, right? For
correct.
Failing to comply with Rule 26. Let me jump in a little bit with the line of questioning Justice Hobbs was pursuing. 26A2, pretty clearly by its preamble there, is designed to deal with experts that would be presenting testimony admitted under 702 or 3 or 5. And those rules, of course, limit when somebody could give testimony, when it would be appropriate to be allowed in. And they also specify things like, particularly 705, the stuff about you don't have to give your underlying data first, but is subject to being cross-examined on that data. So pretty clearly, the discovery rule is designed, isn't it, to provide that information in advance so you'll be able to take advantage of Rule 705 and cross-examine on that. Is rather than a discovery, rather than such a strict discovery violation and sanction, which you, I think, are asking for, which the judge ordered in this case, can this rule, and should it, be construed in such a way as to not consider to not sanction someone for a violation of the rule if they're unable to provide the data, but rather for that to simply work to prevent them from giving opinions that it would be unfair for them to give against you without having that information? And is that the form? I don't mean a lesser sanction in the sense of a discovery sanction, but should the sanction in effect be an evidentiary ruling at trial based on what has been disclosed and what hasn't been?
I think you could in some cases do that sort of balancing and say, do you have the information sufficient to cross-examine on a particular opinion? And if that hasn't been provided in advance, we're going to take out that opinion. I think it would be better to do that prior to trial so everybody knows where you're going in advance, and you could do that through a discovery motion or motion in limine, perhaps. The issue we have in this case is all of the opinions are based on this underlying data. And yes, there are a number of other articles cited and a bibliography attached to the report, but none of those other articles are mentioned in Dr. Lee's actual summary of her testimony that she's considering relying. So even if you were to follow that platform and say, you can't effectively cross-examine under 705, so we can't get these opinions in, all of the opinions would still be excluded. So you'd end up in the same place in this particular case.
Have you made any attempt to get the records from the University of Washington?
We have not.
You have not. Okay.
And the reason is because it is a convoluted process to get letters rogatory, go to the University of Washington, get the University of Washington to issue the subpoena, find the appropriate person at the University of Washington to serve it on, then the Assistant Attorney General from the University of Washington has essentially promised to fight the subpoena. If you read between the lines, he's pretty clear he's not going to just comply. It says we will provide the data.
You probably cooperate in the service, and then you could fight it out on the merits. I mean, you haven't made any attempt, though, right?
Correct. And part of it is basically the time and energy to go into attempting to get this data when it is Dr. Bowen's responsibility under the rules to provide it. And Mr. Garrigan should not be required to do the work for Mr. Bowen to produce the data that Dr. Bowen is supposed to provide to begin with, and the delay it takes, especially when expert disclosures are usually provided 90 days before trial to try to go to the University of Washington and get this data within that time period, would be very difficult, plus to make Mr. Garrigan expend the money it would take to get this data. And there's been
Let me ask you a different question about the Seventh Circuit case you were referring to, with I guess it was an accounting expert, someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
What was the data that you were referring to?
The accounting expert, it's kind of a complicated case involving some mortgage companies and who's responsible for money that's missing from escrow accounts. And the accountant went out and interviewed people from that were involved with the escrow accounts and from other mortgage companies to determine whether they knew what was going on to do some forensic accounting. The data that was missing was information that was apparent to the accountant. The accountant felt didn't assist him at all in reaching opinions. It wasn't that they counteracted his opinions, he just didn't think it mattered.
There was an analysis of the transactions at issue in that lawsuit?
Yes.
Is that your impression? Okay.
And basically, he got rid of it because also his accounting firm's policy said after a certain amount of time, you get rid of this information if you haven't used it. He followed his company's rules, and the Seventh Circuit said, you know what, just because you followed your company's rules and you don't have this data anymore, that's not an excuse not to provide it to the other side when they need it, when you considered it. I would think also the case going to providing information, the Estate of Ford v. Eicher case in the Colorado Court of Appeals, in that case, the information that had to be provided was prior testimony of the expert, and the expert in that case had kept track of his prior testimony. He didn't know what his prior testimony was, what cases he had testified in before, So he could not, literally could not provide it. And the Court of Appeals affirmed sanctions in that case, saying, look, the fact that you didn't keep track of the cases, that you don't have this data anymore, doesn't excuse you from providing it. So even though it may be impossible for you to provide it, that's not an excuse under the rules. Your opponent needs this information. And the sanction in that case wasn't exclusion, but there was, in fact, a sanction in that case that was felt to be commensurate with the violation. So there are cases which say you have to provide the data, and if the rule requires it, and your inability, current inability to do it, is not an excuse. And this makes sense from a policy perspective, because if the expert is relying upon information that expert either cannot or will not share with the opposing party, it puts the opposing party at a great disadvantage in terms of either coming up with a counter expert or coming up with effective cross-examination. And so the further the truth-seeking function, you have to have effective cross-examination. And this court said that in the Gall case. It's been repeated in several Court of Appeals cases and federal cases, that the truth-seeking function in regard to experts requires effective cross-examination, and that requires that the party know what the expert was taking into consideration, both what the expert relied upon and what the expert rejected and said is unimportant, because that can be just as important for cross-examination as what the expert actually relied upon. Again, going back to briefly the issue of whether the information in this case was actually considered by Dr. Lee, again, I would repeat, the court found that Dr. Lee was repeating opinions from her article, and if she's taking these opinions out wholesale, putting them in a report, then the data underlying those original opinions is still what she is relying upon. So under all the facts and circumstances of this case, we'd ask this court to affirm the trial court's discretion and affirm his decision in this matter. Thank you.
I have just a couple of comments to add. Regarding the Seventh Circuit case, the Fidelity case, that was a case where the accountant was hired for the litigation, went out and did an investigation into fraud for the litigation, was given some materials by the party that hired him, and then destroyed some of those materials. So it's a very different situation from what we have here, in that that expert was hired for the litigation, and the missing materials, the materials he couldn't produce, were materials that he was given during the course of the litigation by the attorney. I do want to comment on the severity of this sanction. This is a complete exclusion of Dr. Lee's testimony, although she has many bases for her opinions regarding postoperative vision loss. Her article is not the only article out there, certainly. She's been a researcher in this field, and there are many other people who have researched in this field, and there are 40 articles cited in her endorsement that are the basis for her opinion. I would note that the plaintiff's justification for wanting all this data is we need to check the accuracy of this study. Is this a valid study? Is the underlying data correctly reported and summarized? Neither of plaintiff's experts have ever raised any challenge to the validity of this study. They had an expert, Dr. Patton, who agreed with the results of the study and didn't have any complaint about the validity of the data in the study, and he was withdrawn as an expert by the plaintiff. And then they went out and hired the second expert, Dr. Warner, I believe is his name, and he too agrees with some of the things in the study.
Ms. Moran, did either of these experts review the underlying data?
No, they did not.
So they just said that based on her study, her article, published article, they thought it was okay?
And their knowledge of postoperative vision loss and the rest of medical literature that they knew of reporting on postoperative vision loss.
Can I ask you a quick variation on the question I asked opposing counsel? And that is, would you consider it, even if your thought about Rule 34, say, would just you know, excuse your witness here because this is not something that the witness has in her possession. So you're saying Rule 26 would not be the appropriate way to, as a discovery matter, to get these documents from her. But in any event, would you consider it appropriate for the judge to rule, say, in limine on a matter of evidence? I'm not going to let you give any opinion that you don't provide the underlying data for, because that just wouldn't qualify as an acceptable opinion under, you know, rule whatever, 705 or 702.
I would not agree that that would be an appropriate, whether you want to call it a sanction or a remedy, in this case. First of all, the court ruled on page 3 of its order that it had no reason to believe that this was not a reliable study, and therefore that's why Dr. Roth and Dr. Newman can talk about it, talk about the conclusions of the study, but then they can be cross-examined on the fact they haven't reviewed the underlying data. So that kind of fits in with what I was talking about before, is that there isn't any real evidence that this study is invalid or that the data collection should be questioned. So I think that's important for the court to understand. I think that if there is a way to address the fact that this data is unavailable, it's by cross-examination in some way. I think that probably has to be carefully controlled, because it's not Dr. Lee's fault that this information is not available, and it's not Dr. Bowen's fault that the information is not available. But the court did rule that, you know, Dr. Newman and Dr. Roth can be asked about the fact that they haven't reviewed the data. So there may be a way that preserves Dr. Lee's ability to testify in this case about opinions that she's probably the most qualified expert out there to testify on, and not to exclude her opinions entirely. I also wanted to address Justice Bender and Justice Hobbs, kind of the idea of that was brought out in some of the questioning about, it looks like my time is up, I'm sorry. Thank you for the court for your time.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all the counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted.